Yeah, all right. The English, Rabbi Sheik, last week, the verses that you were reading that were translated anger, in the English, in our English version, they're translated sorrow. And, of course, you miss several times.
Which verse is that?
All right, which verse was that, Jeff? If you looked it up, that was Jeff King. But there were several. I noticed that in Ecclesiastes 1:8, I believe, then. And several of the verses, I think almost every one that you gave, it was where you said anger, it was sorrow.
1:8 is not one of the verses we took with
me. All right. Marvin, that was not one of the verses. All right. Have you got any of them where I can't even... Ooh.
You're talking about the list, right?
Yeah, 18, okay.
Now, what is your translation?
All right, I'm flipping over there right now. I'm getting there. It says, for in much wisdom is much grief.
Nope.
He that increases knowledge increases sorrow.
The last word is right, sorrow. But it says, with much wisdom is much what?
Grief.
Grief?
Yeah, no. G-R-I-E-F.
No, that's not the translation. The word is kaf, which means anger. And let me see how they translate the other verse that I mentioned, which was...
which one, Marvin?
7:3.
Yes.
And they translate grief?
Sorrow is better than laughter.
No. There it says... there it's also anger. What about the other one where he says remove anger from your heart?
It's sorrow.
It says remove sorrow from your heart?
Yeah.
That's absolutely wrong.
11:10. It says remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh.
Nope, that's wrong.
Okay. All right, so that's...
Which one? Is that the Jerusalem translation?
No, this is the basic King James, but the...
Oh, yeah, I'd like to see what the Jerusalem translation is.
Jerusalem translation. Jim Long, where is he? All right, you got your Jerusalem translation. Ecclesiastes 11:10. I didn't bring my JPS with me tonight. I usually have it with me. It says sorrow in JPS also, Rabbi.
In 11:10?
Yes. Well, see, this is the thing that I've said about the JPS. We've had classes on this here. And the JPS, with few exceptions, is a basic King James translation.
That's pretty bad.
It is.
Yeah.
And that's the reason I pushed the JPS for a while,
yeah.
And then I started doing a comparative study. And in most cases, it's no better than the King James, except it has the Hebrew text, and you can look over on the face and page and get the Hebrew text from it. So.
Well, that's it. What can I tell you?
Well, we need to learn Hebrew, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Nothing like the original, huh?
That right. When the Messiah comes, we'll get him to give us a cram course.
That's it. I'm sure he will.
All right. But we are learning a little along. So, okay, so you can take up from there.
Okay.
All right. And we've been rolling for this 5 minutes or so.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. The point that I wanted to make last week, and I think it's probably the most important point in understanding Ecclesiastes, and that is that the nature of his questions, okay? The questions that he's raising from a unique point of view. It's not the question of a religionist. It's not the question of a philosopher. It's the question that only a man like Solomon could ask, because he is armed with the prophetic knowledge, and simultaneously he looks at events that don't support the basic theme of the knowledge. Now, a philosopher can never ask such a question, because a philosopher, everything's question is something true, or is it not true? Either he can prove it, in which case he has no doubt, or if he can't prove it, he has no problem with it. It's just something which he doesn't know. Again, a religionist A religionist, on the other hand, doesn't raise questions for a different reason, because man-made religion is basically nonsensical. It has to be, because it stems from the emotional part of man's makeup. And emotions don't talk reasonably. People try to interpret their emotions into reason, but when you put them to the critical test, it's just not going to work. So the religionist chooses to ban questions, or to turn away from questions, or to twist reality to satisfy himself or herself. Okay, I heard recently that Nancy Reagan said that the fact that her husband has Alzheimer's is a blessing in disguise. Why? Because now the family is getting together. Well, a real blessing would be to be able to raise a family that gets together in good health. But even if I should say that, even if I should forget about that point, the question would, of course, be what is better, to lose your family or to lose your mind? I think that any intelligent person would say, well, if I have to lose, I don't want to lose, I may love my family, but my mind, if I lose my mind, I lost everything. So there again you have the typical approach of people trying to say everything's a blessing, everything's a blessing from God, and trying to twist reality to satisfy their emotional needs. That is not the philosophy of Torah. Torah calls a spade, and Torah never twists anything. Okay, because Torah is the study of the true religion, that we know the facts from prophecy, and we are enjoined, we are obligated to pursue with our minds the understanding of these ideas, and not to sweep anything under the carpet. We're not afraid of questions. We have certain things we don't understand, but we certainly do not twist reality. There's never, in Torah, we never find any kind of virtue in twisting reality to conform to a religious principle. That is not the virtue of Torah. We're very honest, and if we don't know, we don't know. But what I want to make clear, and I know this is a difficult point, but I think it's the most important point in the entire Ecclesiastes, and that is the basis and the type of question that he's asking. You see, he is not questioning the facts of his faith, because those facts he knows from prophecy. What he seems to be questioning, and I'll show you this at this point, we have to just take it tentatively. I'm going to modify it later, but in order to explain it, I have to put it in a certain clear way that I'm going to modify later. Okay. The point is like this, that what he's doing here is he's asking certain questions. He's showing that reality does not conform, or would seem not to conform, to any of the principles even of his faith, which means even things which he knows to be true, reality doesn't seem to conform to it. Now, again, when I say, and now I'm going to modify that a bit, when I say doesn't conform, I don't mean to say that he sees things in reality that contradict his faith. That's not true. Because any person that would see things in reality that contradict his faith would be hopelessly lost, according in the faith of Torah. Because the faith of Torah is based on reason. Now, if your reason tells you A, and your eyes tell you B, and then you're stuck. You're simply gone. Because Torah tells you your eyes is something that reason tells you to accept as what you see as being true. The whole event of Sinai was something which was visual, observable. Torah starts off with the foundation that we accept the senses and we accept the mind. So if you have something from reality that destroys the principles of Torah, then your system, belief system, according to Torah, is impossible. Okay? And Torah maintains that there is nothing in reality that contradicts any of the ideas of Torah. Alright? So, that being the case, we come back to the question of, so what is he asking? Okay, what is he asking, if that's the case? And because he doesn't have anything that contradicts the ideas of Torah, alright? So what is his question then? Alright? And this is the point I'm trying to get across. His question is like this. His question is based on psychology. In modern terms, we would call it ego psychology, okay? In psychoanalytic terms, we call it ego psychology. Now, ego psychology means that man must function in a certain way. And the way he functions is that there is a lot of energy that is driving towards a certain kind of satisfaction that he must satisfy in order to function. Okay? Now, what Ecclesiastes is showing is that in reality, if a person were wise, he would not be able to function neither in the lifestyles of the secular world, which are non-religious world. He would be defeated in that type of a lifestyle. And even, he goes further, even in the lifestyle of the religious world, he is also going to be defeated. Now, when I say defeated, again, I don't mean to say that Ecclesiastes is showing something which goes, which is something from reality that goes against his principles. Then, of course, he would be defeated even according to Torah. Because according to Torah, your belief system has to be based on knowledge, and if you have contrary knowledge, then you're just stuck, and that's it. You're just gone. But we maintain, of course, that there's nothing in reality that contradicts Torah, and there isn't. So now his question, however, is not a question that what he sees in reality is against Torah in a logical sense, but it is against Torah in a psychological sense, and it's against any kind of lifestyle in a psychological sense. What do I mean by a psychological sense? By a psychological sense, I mean that a person's psyche is constructed in a certain way, and in order for a person to function, his psyche must be capable of a certain type of satisfaction. If he doesn't have that kind of satisfaction, he simply can't function. Because man is, according to Ecclesiastes, a psychological being. At bottom, interesting thing about Torah is that Torah blends psychology and philosophy. And philosophy and psychology are really one in Torah. In a university, in a modern-day university, these two subjects are separate. They're treated as if they're two separate things. Torah maintains that cannot be done. Psychology and philosophy have to be combined. And that is really the uniqueness of the Torah approach, is that it combines both of those sciences. Now, what Ecclesiastes is saying, just to give an example, is any lifestyle you take, if you will be honest, you will be defeated. Okay, and that's what he means by the verse I mentioned last week, 1:18. He says, because with more knowledge, there is more anger. Okay, and he who increases his knowledge increases pain. On the other hand, he states many times that knowledge is the greatest thing, and knowledge is something which gives you life, and which would seem to be a contradiction. But it's not a contradiction. Again, his method of contradictions, and we will take that up, all the contradictions, and show you that how from the contradictions, if you study them, you really understand his ideas. That's his method. His method is contradiction to alert you to some insight. Now, over here, what he's saying is like this. He's saying, with more knowledge is more anger, which means anger, we explained over here, is philosophical anger, which means anger against reality, because reality doesn't conform to what you want. And he says, he who increases his knowledge increases there, the word is sorrow, is correct, or pain. Literally means pain. So if you increase your knowledge, you increase your pain. What he means is like this. What he means is that if a person, let us take the lifestyle, for instance, the one that he takes first, which is a secular lifestyle. And again, the Torah, the philosophy of Torah is that one must study and one must investigate. If it was just a simple religion, you wouldn't need Ecclesiastes. Okay, but Torah demands complete knowledge and insight and not to sweep anything under the carpet. Now he says over here, he says, he writes in the beginning, in 2, he starts talking about how he himself built up his houses, his palaces, his gardens. That's Ecclesiastes 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, okay? And finally, in summation, he said he had money, he had servants, he had beautiful brooks, and he had his own private beautiful gardens and woods and anything a person can dream of, and all kinds of enjoyments, and all kinds of treasures. Okay, that's what he expresses in these verses. And in 9, he says, and I became more great, and I increased more than anyone that was before me in Jerusalem. Okay? And he says, my knowledge stood by me. And then he says, in other words, what he said, the reason why he says knowledge stood by him is because what he's saying over here is that he was an individual who was able, a rare individual, who was able to perform an experiment on himself. In other words, he studied himself, and he studied his own mind and his own emotions and how these things affected him. See, most people cannot do that. Most people's emotions and their mind are the same thing. They can't distinguish between one part of themselves and another. But Ecclesiastes is saying, he says, no, my knowledge stood by me. In spite of my indulgence in these pleasures, I was always studying myself to see how these pleasures are affecting me and how my psyche, how my mind is working. Okay? And then he continues in 10, and he says, everything that my eyes wanted, I didn't refrain. I didn't refuse them. And I didn't prevent my heart from any kind of happiness, because my heart was happy from all my work. And he says, and this was my portion. This is what I got from all my work. And then he says, in other words, what he's saying over here clearly is that he wasn't the person that was incapable of happiness. There are people that just can't enjoy things. You know, I mean, basically, no matter what happens, they're incapable of pleasure. That, according to Torah, is a sick individual, an ascetic, a person that just can't enjoy life. That's a sickness. The Jerusalem Talmud states a person that can't enjoy something, then there's something wrong with them. The Torah does not consider that to be a good thing. If a person by nature should be able to enjoy life, should have a psyche that's capable of enjoyment. Usually you'll find the deeply religious psyche, what the world calls as religious, is one who is incapable of physical pleasure. This is a defect, not a virtue in Torah. And that's what he's saying over here, where he states that I didn't prevent my heart from any kind of happiness. And he says, because my heart was happy from all its work, that's in verse 10, 2:10, and this was my portion from all my work. In other words, his enjoyment. He was able to enjoy everything that he had. He didn't have any psychological problems, in other words. Okay? Then he says in 11, and I turned to look at all the actions that I did and all the work that all the effort and work that I exerted to do, he says, and behold, everything was nothingness and frustration, and there is nothing extra, so to speak, nothing worthwhile under the sun. Over here, what he's portraying the lifestyle of the empire builder, and he's saying that the empire builder, if he were really honest with himself, he would see that all the effort and all the work that he does, even though he may have these pleasures, these momentary pleasures, first of all, these momentary pleasures don't equal the pain and the effort that he has to put into it. If he were really honest, he would see that it is not a worthwhile endeavor. The effort, the pain, exceeds the pleasure tremendously. That's number one. Number two is the satisfaction that a person receives from these things. Even if he's psychologically sound and healthy, the satisfaction is momentary. It is something which does not have any kind of lasting effect on the person's psyche. And the person, in a short time, just thinks, looks at what he has, and just thinks it's nothing. In other words, the person who lives, and put it in simple terms, the person who lives in a $100,000 home and the person who lives in a $1 million home, these two people, there is basically no difference. In other words, the excitement of the $1 million home is, and the striving for it and the work and the effort that's expended and that's put into it, the pain and the effort that goes into it far exceeds the pleasure, and that's one. And two, the pleasure is very short-lived, and in a short time the person does not realize where he's living anyways, and he just went up one step, but now in terms of his psychological energies, he really is no different than he was before. And in other words, a person gets used to these things very quickly, and it's all nothing. So a person can never think to himself that this is really something great. And again, he's basing himself on his psychology, which is that man is always looking for something great. Man isn't happy with the practical. That's not something that's going to make a person happy. A person wants to be great, whether he wants to be a great hero, a great politician, or something great. But in his mind, he has to feel there's something great. And this is where he shows that the physical pleasures is one of the lifestyles. He goes through every single lifestyle. But this is one of every single major lifestyle. This is one of the lifestyles where he's talking about the accumulation of wealth, just for its own sake, for the enjoyment of wealth, and thinking that this is truly the great thing in life. What the wise king is saying is that to think that way is impossible. The only one that will think that way is a fool, not an intelligent person. Because a fool will always delude himself and will always underplay the things that he doesn't want to see. But if a person were really honest, he wouldn't do that, and he would see that it really is worthless, and all this effort and all this fantasy. The fantasy that he built up about this thing is never the reality. The reality isn't even an important percentage of the fantasy. So the end result is frustration. Okay? That's basically what he's saying. That's why he says that the person who has more knowledge has more anger. Anger, again, being defined as when a person is unhappy with what he sees. So here he shows that this has nothing to do with religion, you see. It has to do with analysis of life. And the Torah demands we analyze every lifestyle. Even the lifestyle of the wicked man has to be analyzed. Because we are after knowledge. Now, over here he's just taking the lifestyle of the pleasure seeker, okay, and he's showing that the pleasure seeker's fantasy and the work and the effort and the anticipation is tremendous, and the gain is short-lived, small, and leaves him in a state of frustration. Okay. But then he analyzes other lifestyles, and including the religious lifestyle. And he shows that even the religious lifestyle has its problems. Now, again, when I say, the reason why I'm bringing this in, I will go through some of the lifestyles, but why I'm bringing this in is to show you exactly what I mean by the nature of his question. His question is not, that there's something out there that destroys the principles of Torah. That's not his question. His question is, can the Torah life be a psychologically satisfying life based upon the principles of human psychology? Because if a life is supposed to be a good life for a person, it's got to work, and it's got to be psychologically satisfying. And here's where he shows that the lifestyle of the Torah life has problems as well. And this is where he says, for instance, let me show you. Where he says, for instance, where he says, for instance, the lifestyle of the wise, which is right following, right at 2, we left off at 2:11, where he gets, there he's finished with lifestyle of the pleasure seeker, the Sybarite. But then take a look at the lifestyle at 13. He says, we're at 12 and 13, where he says he studied wisdom, and he also studied the lifestyle of the wise and the lifestyle of the fool. Okay? And then he says like this. He says, and I saw that there's tremendous benefit in wisdom over foolishness. It's like the benefit of light to darkness. And then he goes on to 14. The wise man, his eyes are in his head. In other words, means to say that he sees what's happening. He understands reality. That's a different kind of a life. He says the fool walks in darkness. He doesn't know what's going to happen to him. He has no concept of what's around him. He lacks knowledge in every way. So you would say from this, say, okay, so forget the lifestyle that you mentioned before, the lifestyle of the pleasure seeker. Yeah, that's all frustration and fantasy. And when the time comes, the satisfaction is never any sizable degree of the in terms of the fantasy, okay, and the illusion. So you're left with frustration. Fine. Let's leave that lifestyle. Let's take the lifestyle of the wise. Now here we have something that's fantastic. Wisdom. What is greater than wisdom? Nothing is greater than wisdom. Everybody will agree that knowledge and wisdom is something that is the greatest thing man has. Okay, it's great in every way. It's great in your practical life. It's great in terms of understanding science. It's great in terms of producing the technology. It's great in terms of understanding the universe. That's the greatest thing possible, right? So he says, and the fool is like an animal, basically. He has no knowledge at all. So he says that's right. That's what he expresses in verse 14. But then he says, and I know at the same time that one occurrence will occur to both of them, to all of them. And he says in 15, and I said in my heart that the occurrence or the fate of the fool will happen to me too. And why did I then become wise? What gain did I have in becoming wiser than somebody else? And I said in my heart, this too is emptiness. Okay? And then he goes on to say that the wise man, he says that in terms of remembering, he says there is no remembrance for the wise man and the fool. And he says everything's forgotten after a while, whether you are wise or whether you are a fool, the whole thing's forgotten after you die. And he says, and how is it possible that the wise man should die with a fool? This is one of his big questions. In other words, his question is like this, that if you're going to psychologically, if you're going to, and philosophically, if you're going to say that there's something worthwhile in this life, in this human existence, then you'd have to say it's wisdom and knowledge. I mean, an intelligent person would say that. That's greatness. That's man. And Albert Einstein, who understands the universe, that's a great man. Okay? A great Torah scholar, a person that has knowledge of God's works that were given through prophecy, that's a great man. Okay? Who's going to deny that? Nobody in their right mind would deny knowledge. But he says the truth of the matter is that knowledge, when a person thinks of knowledge in psychological terms, a person is awed by knowledge. There's an awe. There's an awe to be standing in the presence of an Albert Einstein. And you know, there's a blessing that we have to recite when you're in the presence of a great scientist, because it's an awesome thing. And but he says there's only one problem with that. The awe takes this great person and raises him to something above everything else. If you want to be honest with yourself, you can't equate an Albert Einstein with a total idiot. I mean idiot. I don't mean psychological, pathological terms. I mean in clinical terms. I mean an idiot, a fool, an average fool. How can you equate these two people? Well, one man's mind spans the universe, and the other man has a hard time just keeping track of his day. I mean, it's like silly. You can't compare the two, okay? But then he says, but if that's the case, there's something that's very disturbing about that, too, because they both die the same way. Now, anyone that is honest with himself would say that if wisdom is really so great, and a human being that is on a really great intellectual level, plane, that such a human being, it should be expressed somehow. Somehow it should be expressed in his life, in his physical existence. I mean, if God made the world in line with human wisdom, and wisdom is the most important thing, and you can't compare the life of a wise man to the life of a simpleton who basically lives on a level a little bit higher than the animal, how you can't compare these two lives, then there should be some kind of a difference. Nature should express itself differently towards these two people. The wise man shouldn't die like the fool. There should be some difference. Maybe he should live twice as long. I don't know. Three times or whatever it might be. But certainly he shouldn't be prone to the same fate as a fool. There should be some kind of a difference out there. If you're going to tell me that wisdom is really the greatest thing. Okay? Now again, the Ecclesiastes is based on a very Ecclesiastes is saying is that the reason why people don't raise this question is not because the question is not a question, and I've seen many intelligent people discuss this question, even scientists. Well, you know, they're not philosophers, but here and there, you know, you see they do express themselves in their personal and the anecdotes about them. They express themselves they talk about these topics. And I have found that what they usually do is to try to downplay the fact of death. Well, it's something that, look, we have to, let's not think about it, or if you think like that, then you can't live. That's not the way to think. But, you see, that's not what Ecclesiastes is all about. Ecclesiastes is an honest person. He's not going to just put something out of his mind because it's going to make him unhappy. That is not a motive of a true philosopher. And King Solomon was a true philosopher. Therefore, King Solomon is very straight about this, very blunt about this. He says, if you're going to raise this thing to a superhuman level, and that's what we do, then how come nature doesn't seem to indicate? And he has no indication from nature that this is really superhuman, because nature treats the fool and the wise man in the exact same manner. Not only the fool and the wise man, but the animal and the man, okay? They all succumb to this, simply the physical fate of death. And the physical fate of death cannot be talked away. If you want to talk it away, you just want to fool yourself. But the fact is, when I look at reality, I don't see any indication that the life of the wise person is that which I think. I think, in other words, when I look for something Yisroel, that extra, something fantastic, something which is great, which the human mind is looking for, that satisfaction of something really great, you're going to find that there is no recognition whatsoever in nature for that greatness, which is a very disturbing type of thing. Again, his question is a psychological question. It doesn't disprove the fact that wisdom is important and that wisdom is the greatest thing in the world. He doesn't disprove that. All he's saying is that if a person is honest, it is very difficult to carry on or to attach such great importance to wisdom when there's no indication from nature that it really is so superior. Okay? That's the type of question he asks, okay? Again, he brings up this Dave mentioned verse 18. In verse 18, what he's doing is he's returning to the life of the he does swing back and forth, but his principles are straight. What he's saying is that over here he says in verse 18 and 19 and 20, he says, and 21, what he's saying is that the empire builder, there are two fantasies the empire builder has. One is the fantasy of pleasure, that he's going to enjoy himself. That fantasy, he says, immediately he sees is very frustrating. Then he says that there's another fantasy, a fantasy that he built an empire, something lasting. A person wants that. This emotion that's looking for greatness would be satisfied if a person could find that he produced something lasting, an empire. What do tyrants want? What they want to do is to produce something that will last, that will be lasting. So the empire builders. But what he says here is, he says that's an impossibility, because he says that a person has no control of what happens after he's gone. And he has to leave it, let's say at best he leaves it to his children, if he has children. Okay? So he says, yes, but then the problem is like this. Or to another individual, anyone. But the problem is, you have no way of knowing whether that person is going to, what he's going to do with what all your work. You work meticulously to accumulate this thing, and he can destroy it in no time because he's a fool. Okay, which means to say the fantasy of eternity that's attached to empire building is again an illusion, which if a person were logical and he thought into it, he would never venture on such an endeavor. That's what he's saying. That's what he's saying basically, that any person that were really logical wouldn't try to do any of these things, which means that if a person were really logical, he would be devastated, wouldn't do anything. But what King Solomon is saying is that is what a logical person should do. Basically, nothing, because when you analyze everything you do, it really is worthless. Okay? So you'll say, well, what kind of a philosophy is that? That sounds like a sick kind of philosophy. So what are we supposed to do? Sit at home and do nothing? Well, King Solomon would say to you, if you want to be rational about it, you have a choice. If you want to be rational, then you have to see that life basically is not satisfying. You can't tell me that because you want to live, that circular reason, because you want to live, so I'm going to say things are great, then you're simply fooling yourself. You must be, if you're really looking for truth, then you must be honest. And if honesty tells you that it's worthless, then you're stuck. You have no choice. It's true. Functionally, you're stuck, but that's the truth. You have to look at the truth, okay? King Solomon is demanding that a person, that the truth comes over everything. First, we must know what the truth is. All right, and let's not worry about results. Now, he says, he has the religious life where he mentions, just give me a second. Okay. If you take a look at three sixteen, okay, where he says, and also I've seen under the sun that in the place of judgment there is wickedness, and the place of righteousness there is the wicked, okay. Okay. Now over here, you see, over here, let's just go further. So I said in my heart that the righteous and the wicked God will judge. Because there's a time for everything and for every action. What he means is as follows. He means, okay, so he takes a look at the world and he says, well, okay, let's see, justice. That's something we could say is very important. All right, that's something which gives a man hope, which makes a person think there's something real out there. This person is endowed by God with a sense of justice. And certainly that is something which is a worthwhile institution. And when a person sees justice, it picks a person up. When a person sees injustice, it puts them down because it makes them feel that everything is hopeless. But now he says as follows. He says, okay, but I took a look at the places of justice and I saw that there was injustice there. Why was there injustice there? For a very simple reason. Because people really aren't interested in justice. They're interested in the appearance of justice. But real justice, they're not interested in. Now he says as follows. He says, so I said in my heart that the righteous and the wicked God will judge. Okay, so the guy got away, but God's going to judge him. But then he says, later he says that, the fate of man and the fate of the animal, and there's one fate to them. As this one dies, that one dies. He says, and there's nothing special in man or extra superior in man over the animal, because everything is nothingness. All right? So there what he says is, that this we don't see corroborated from reality either. Because we would think that the person that is righteous, a righteous person, there should be some indication in nature that he is treated differently. And yet we see nothing in nature that makes any difference between the righteous person and the evil person. The evil person can live to be 85 and 90, and the righteous person can live to be 85 and 90. There is no, we do not see nature differentiating. There again, we have a problem when we speak about the righteous and the wicked. The problem is, it's all very nice, but to say that the righteous man is going to, God is going to judge and the wicked God is going to judge. But do we see a corroboration in nature for such a thing? No, we don't. There are many Nazis that are alive and well into their 80s. We do not see in nature that the person who is wicked lives a short life, and the person that's righteous lives a long life. So there is no corroboration again. So now if we're going to take righteousness, and we're going to say that this is the thing which is the great thing, not wisdom, but the righteousness is the great thing, well, how come again there's no indication from reality that this is so? This is the question that King Solomon is raising. Now, I just want to show you on the same point something which I think is quite important, and that is, take a look at chapter 8, take a look at chapter 8, 11, 12, and 13. Now take a look at what he says here. He says, see what he says? He says, because of the fact that the evil doesn't occur swiftly, that's why the heart of man is filled with the idea of doing evil. All right? Let's take one more verse. He says, a sinner does much, much evil, and he has a long life. Okay? God gives him a lengthy existence. Now take a look what he says. He says, I also know that it will be good for those that fear God. It will be good for those that fear God that they should fear him. And then he says, and it will not be good for the wicked, and the wicked will not have lengthy days like the shadow. He who has no fear before God. So it sounds like a contradiction. First he says that the wicked person will that the wicked person can do evil for a long time and get away with it, right? And then he says, but I also know that it's not true, that those that fear God will have good, and the wicked will not have lengthy days. So what is he saying over here? This is an absolute contradiction. Okay. But in the light of what I am explaining, these verses show exactly the nature of his question. You see, his question, again, is not contradiction. Why? Because the basic philosophy of Torah is that the person that is the good individual, the one that fears God, has a good life. And the person that is evil has a bad life. Okay? Now, that he maintains is true. But there are two ways to maintain it's true. One way to maintain it's true is from the lifestyle itself. In other words, if I could show you that the person that is evil must intrinsically be unhappy because he's torn by his emotions, he's torn by fantasy, he's in conflict with his mind, he's going against reality, he is a person like the prophet says that the wicked are turbulent like the sea. So the turbulence in his existence means that every day that he exists is a torturous existence. Whereas the righteous person, every day that he exists is a wonderful experience because his soul is in harmony. He's an individual that has a harmonious soul, and the enjoyment in life that the righteous have is not comparable. One moment, living one moment as a righteous person, even a month or a year, is by far greater existence than the longest lifespan possible for the wicked, because the wicked is a person who's in disharmony. His soul's in disharmony. His soul's at odds with itself, and therefore cannot enjoy life. So what King Solomon, that's what King Solomon says over here. I know, he says, he asked the question, he says, the reason why people do evil is because nothing befalls them suddenly. Person goes and does something evil, he's not going to get struck by lightning, okay? And that's why he says, that's why people continue to do evil. Because they expect the punishment to be swift and sudden by God. And no, you see that a person can do evil, and he can live a long life. But he says, I also know the fact that it is good, it will be good, it is good for the person that fears God. And I know that the evil man will never know good, and he will not, over here he says he will not, his life will be like a shadow. Over here, when he means a shadow, what he means is not in length of time, but he means in terms of his quality of life. The quality of his life is like a shadow, is nothing. Whereas the quality of life of the righteous is the height of the potential that a human being has for life. So therefore, what he's saying is as follows. He's saying that I know that the principles of the Torah are true. But the one thing that's disturbing, he says, is that according to the way the human psyche works, again, it would seem that a person is looking, an individual is looking for something that he can consider great. And if righteousness is something that I can consider great, then it should not be true that the righteous man suffers the same fate as the evil man. And it should not be true that the wicked should be able to be wicked for a very long time and nothing happen to them. Okay? So you understand what his question is? His question is not that the life of the wicked is equal to the life of the righteous. No, there's no comparison. He says it. I know that it's not true. I know that the person that really is, that is good has a much better life. But again, it's not something that I could point to and say, this is something I could attach that emotion of greatness to and say, wow, this is a life. If that were the case, then nature again should really support that system. And it should take the life of the righteous and raise him above any kind of harm, and the life of the wicked should result in immediate destruction and harm. But it doesn't work that way. So when you look around at life, he says, again, there's no support for the idea that the righteousness, that is the unbelievable thing, the awesome thing that exists for human life. If that were the case, then there should be some corroboration from nature, and there isn't. Okay? That, again, is his question. That's his type of question. It's the same thing where he says in the beginning, he says that everybody dies, so he says, who knows the soul of a human being that goes up and the soul of the animal that goes down? He's not denying it. Again, grammatically what he's saying is that it's true, but he's saying that's very nice to know that in your mind. But still, it's disturbing that there's nothing out there in nature that supports that. Okay? That is the gist of his question. Okay? All right. I think we've clarified the nature of the question of King Solomon, and the fact that this question can only be raised by a person who is in the framework of Torah. It cannot be raised by a religionist. A religious person doesn't like to see these things and likes to just sweep them under the carpet. Cannot be raised by a philosopher, because a philosopher doesn't have information other than his own philosophical ideas. So either he proves them, or else he doesn't prove them. But King Solomon is in a unique position, because he has information from Torah, and yet there is a very disturbing reality out there that doesn't support the human being's need for feeling that he's attached to something, that there's something out there that's fantastic. Whether it's a secular kind of a life, whether it's empire building, or whether it's a religious life, or whether it's the life of wisdom, these lifestyles are not supported by reality in the manner that we seek for them to be supported. In other words, they're not supported in a way that we could say, hey, this is a fantastic thing, look out there. Okay. And man seeks corroboration from reality. Okay. What I'd like to do now is to, by the way, the height of man seeking corroboration from reality is messianics. What is the whole concept of messianics is people, but this is actually a low level, which King Solomon wouldn't even address, because King Solomon is addressing, true philosophical problems. But the people that are into messianism, the reason why they're involved in that is because they don't even have any knowledge of the principles of Torah, and since they don't have any knowledge, they really at bottom are looking for support from some kind of miraculous event that their system is correct. Okay? But that's only for a person that doesn't even have the knowledge of Torah. A person that has knowledge of Torah doesn't need any external corroboration for the fact that it's correct, because he knows it's correct through an understanding of divine prophecy and an understanding of why these facts that has been transmitted to him are true. But still, King Solomon says, the fact that it lacks the external corroboration is something which is disturbing to the human psyche and prevents it from functioning in the full sense. And Torah demands that the psyche of man function in the full sense. Now, there is an answer to his question, but we're not going to get to it this week. What I'd like to take up now is to go back to something that we mentioned before, and that is the statement of the rabbis, okay, because we started that last week. The statement of the rabbis in the tractate of Sabbath 30b is that they had wished to put the book of Kohelet, of Ecclesiastes, into Geniza. Now, this word, Geniza, all right, you'll hear many many historians or Bible critics that know of this rabbinical statement. They'll give you all kinds of interpretations. The rabbis wanted to ban the book, they'll tell you, or for some reason they couldn't ban it, but they wanted to ban it. Well, you see, I want to make one thing clear, that these the words of the rabbis can only be understood if you know exactly what these terms mean, and they have a very unique meaning. The word banning is not the word geniza. Geniza means the word lignos, in geniza, as you're probably familiar with, that word does not mean to ban. The word geniza means when a sefer Torah becomes old and it starts to disintegrate, so you put it into geniza, which means you put it into, you bury it, put it in the ground. So what the word geniza means is to put a sefer Torah into the ground. That's why we don't have many old Torahs, because that's still the halacha. The halacha is they're supposed to bury it. Now, what exactly do the rabbis mean over here when they say that they wished to put the book of Kohelet, of Ecclesiastes, into Geniza, and why did they want to do it? All right. So the rabbi said because his words contradict each other. And then it says, and why did they not do it? Because in the beginning and the end he states that the important thing is to follow the way of the Torah. Okay, I'll explain exactly what that means. The word to ban something is not lignos, but it's lesor. And there are books that are banned. The rabbis did ban certain books. Okay, books on physiognomy, for instance, that a person's face indicates whether he's... There are books on physiognomy. They are even around today, that the shape of a person's face indicates whether he's intelligent or not, or what kind of a soul he has. These kind of things were banned by the rabbis. Okay? We don't believe in such type of things. So that was banned, but that's not lignos. They would never use the word lignos. That means they should simply say that it's prohibited and should be destroyed. But to understand what the word lignos means and why they wanted to do geniza to the book of Ecclesiastes, you have to understand really what the problem was. You see, now there are certain things, as I mentioned last week, that are endowed with the quality of the written word. Okay? And the five books of Moses are unique. They are the written word, and that's from God. Now, the books of the prophets, okay, also can be endowed with the quality of the written word. All right. Now, what the rabbis wanted to do, you see, what's the difference between the written word and between the non-written word? And what do the rabbis mean when they say because there was contradiction? There are many contradictions in between Mishnahs. There are hundreds and thousands of contradictions straight through the oral law. All kinds of questions and answers. And the question is because you have something which seems to be contradictory. So this is nothing new to the rabbis. The rabbis, the rabbis' analytical life thrives on what seems to be contradiction. So why were the rabbis disturbed over here with contradiction when all the Mishnahs are elucidated in the manner of showing a contradiction between one source and another source and then explaining it? Obviously, they didn't think that King Solomon wrote something which is intrinsically contradictory. That would be silly. So they knew that there was a deeper understanding behind the words. So what's wrong with that? The answer is you have to understand the difference between the written word and between the oral word. The written word is something which every individual has a right to own. In other words, it is something which is public property. Okay, it's domain of the public. The oral word is something which is a deeper understanding of the written word. That's only transmitted to scholars. Okay, again, one is not permitted to write down the oral word. Not permitted to. The reason why we have the oral word in writing is simply because we had no choice. It would be if it comes to a question of losing it completely or writing it down, we're permitted to have the lesser of the two evils, which is write it down and don't lose it. But if you could keep a system of memorization, which was done for many, many years with people that had phenomenal memories, so if you have a photographic memory, then it should be done that way, preferably. But once the people were driven out of the land and the system was already in jeopardy, so the decision was made that if we don't write it down, it's going to be lost. But it is not supposed to be written down. Okay? Now, what the rabbis are saying is they wished that the problem with Ecclesiastes is that a book that's made for the public should not be externally or even on the surface appear as if it's contradictory, because then you're just going to confuse the people. So contradiction is fine, but it's okay in the oral system, but not in the written system. That's why the rabbis said that they never said they wanted to ban Ecclesiastes. What they said was they wanted to do Geniza. What is Geniza? Geniza is when you take the written word and put it in the earth and allow it to disintegrate. So what does it mean over here? What do they wish to do? They wished to remove the value of the written word from Ecclesiastes. They didn't want to ban it. It would then become an oral law. It would become an oral tradition. In other words, once they would remove the sanctity of the written word from it, and that the determination of whether it should be a written word or not is determined by the scholars of the generation. So the scholars of the generation have a right to say that this book should not really be endowed with the quality of the written word. If they do that, it's not banned, but you aren't permitted to write it anymore. And since you're not permitted to write it, it's going to be lost to the masses, and the only ones that are going to have it are the scholars. Okay? So I'm explaining what is meant by the term Geniza, that they wish to take Ecclesiastes and place it into Geniza. What it means is they wished it's borrowed from the law that a Sefer Torah, when it deteriorates, it place it in the ground, and which means to say they don't. What they're doing is it disintegrates and it's not in writing anymore. The same thing over here. They wish to remove the quality, the halachic status of the written word from Ecclesiastes. If they would do that, you wouldn't be permitted to write it. If you wouldn't be permitted to write it, it would become oral. Only scholars would know it, and the masses would soon forget it because it's not available in writing. And the scholarship, masses aren't really scholars, so it would be lost pretty soon from among the masses. But the reason why the rabbis wish to do that is because they said that anything which appears on the surface as contradictory and requires analysis to understand should not be in the hands of the public, because it's just going to confuse them.
Rabbi?
Yes.
You got about 15 seconds.
Okay.
I've been trying to get your attention.
I'm sorry.
All right, go.
Okay, so therefore what they did was, they concluded that it's not going to harm the public, because the beginning of the book and the end of the book maintains the basic premise that one must follow God's commandments, and that they decided would have a greater effect on the people than the confusing middle. And people would simply say, we don't understand it, but this is his conclusion, and they wouldn't be harmed by the fact that the book does have seeming contradictions.